Welcome, you guys. We've been in Lent for about 10 days now, and it's been a good time to just reflect on some more sober things. Were any of you guys at the Ash Wednesday service we had last week? Anybody from this crowd come to that? Yeah, it was a pretty intense time. Lent is going to intrude a little bit on our talk today, as it probably should, because the series we're in right now, as we're following Jesus towards the cross, is Lenten anyway. So Tim timed this pattern really well in that regard. So Lent actually peculiarly is going to interject into this discussion today, because as I was reading the passage, Jesus brings in a theme that has a real Lenten connection, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I have a confession to make. Some of us are fasting on Wednesdays, and so last week I met with some of the staff members who were also fasting, and we had an early morning meeting on Wednesday, but I didn't think of the day, and I came to the table, and they all looked at it. It was like Phil and Mike and a couple other people, and they looked at me, and they're like, "What are you doing?" And I had a scone in my hand, and I was just so hungry. I got there, and I was like, "I need food," and so I have to make a confession that I didn't fast that morning, but that gives you guys freedom to like know if you blow it, don't feel like it's the end of the world for those of you who are choosing to fast, because anyway. So Jesus brings up baptism in this passage, as we're going to see shortly, and we'll talk a little bit more about just the deep connection. I've just been discovering the deep connection between Lent and baptism in our faith, and it is pretty profound. So we'll take a little detour in the middle of it as we're looking at Jesus' rooting authority and actually in the ministry of baptism. But first, I want to read a little bit from a guy named Conrad Gempf, who wrote a book about Jesus' peculiar way of interacting with people. He asked a lot of questions. And in this passage, he asks a profound question and uses that to make a profound statement. But let me read this little section to you. Clark Superman Kent suffered from two weaknesses that did not plague Jesus or my childhood friend Richie: kryptonite and bad dialogue. Richie had a peculiar way of getting your attention. Here's the scene. I would be discussing something Richie didn't care about. If he wanted to change the subject, he didn't ask, "Hey, can we talk about something else?" He also didn't ask the even more involving, "You know what?" Instead, he would employ a special gambit. 30-odd years later, I can still remember him looking at me earnestly and saying, "Conrad, I want to ask you something." I've known people like this too. As a rhetorical tactic, this was worthy of the ancient orators. I can easily imagine Demosthenes and Cicero congratulating Richie. Even the most subtle and complex debates about which superhero would win in a fight wound up ceding the conversational playing field to Richie's, "I want to ask you something." Now, Jesus, as best we can tell from the records, is similar to my friend Richie in this. At the Olympic level of sprint, intermediate, and long-distance conversation hijacking, not even Richie would have a chance against Jesus. But unlike Richie, Jesus actually did get around to asking the questions. In fact, one of the most surprising things about the Gospels is that they report Jesus as asking questions more often than not. Now, Jesus is going to engage again in that practice, as we'll see shortly when we read the text together. But just to do a little bit of review, last week, because this week's passage is a result of what happened last week. And last week, Tim taught on Jesus coming in and storming the temple. He came in like a tornado, actually, kind of like we experienced today, and just disrupted the affairs. Well, I don't know if we actually had a tornado, but Jesus was a tornado. He disrupted the affairs of these people in this system that God had intended for good, that they had perverted into something oppressive. And Jesus came in and pronounced a powerful judgment on it and aroused the anger of a lot of people, as we're going to start seeing the evidence this week. Now, on the topic of anger, Tim last week, he talked about just anger being an okay thing and Jesus demonstrating a righteous way of being angry. But just before that, I just want to show something fascinating. One of my favorite verses in all of Scripture is Mark 11:11, where Jesus walks in. The first thing he does when he gets to Jerusalem after this long journey, he walks into the temple, he stops, and he looks around, And he's thinking something. The text doesn't say, but I think I know what he's thinking. He, knowing what comes next, he walks out. He steps and looks around, and then he walks out kind of calmly and goes out to where he's staying and comes back the next morning. And I'm just picturing Jesus looking around and saying, yep, tomorrow I'm going to come back and just kick the mess out of you people. I'm going to come turn this place upside down, but I need to go home and sleep on it. And so he goes back. It's just an odd statement, like that verse being inserted there. It's just very interesting that that would be included in Mark's details. But then the next day, Jesus comes back, as we looked at last week, and he pronounces judgment in word and in action in the temple. And so this verse 11 is really more like the calm before the storm that erupts in the passage last week. But this week we're going to read the text Mark 11:27-33, and if you guys want to join me, we're going to read it here. They arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders came to him. "By what authority are you doing these things?" they asked. "And who gave you authority to do this?" Jesus replied, "I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I am doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? Tell me." They discussed it among themselves and said, "If we say from heaven, he will ask, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say of human origin," they feared the people, for everyone held that John really was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, "We don't know." Jesus said, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things." While we were reading that, my friend Timothy over here, he's the best scripture reader I've ever known. He inflects all the statements so incredibly. That cracks me up. You almost distracted me for a minute. It was good. He reads scriptures in those groups we're a part of, and Suzanne and I agree that, like, we should all read scripture more like Timothy. It's very dramatic and inflected. But anyway, sorry to call attention to you. Do you guys have any observations on that text or anything that jumped out at you? Yeah, Peggy. Yeah. Yeah, that's all. This morning someone pointed out too, that Jesus was really kind of playing along in their game. He's like, "Okay, if you want to play games and kind of have these subtle challenges, I'll flip this one back on you too." And it's like tit for tat. It was almost playful in a little bit of a way. It was interesting. Yeah.
This is not the freshest moment of Jesus. This is totally the Jesus that he's not guileless. He's not all meek and mild. He's intellectually checkmating these guys.
Yeah, Timothy was pointing out that this is not the precious moments Jesus. he's intellectually checkmating these guys, and he's being extremely intense. And on that note, if you guys want to see a good movie about Jesus, The Gospel of John, it came out about a year and a half ago. It is a word-for-word translation of The Gospel of John. And of all the depictions of Jesus, this one is amazing. It's not the meek little quiet guy. It's the kick butt and take names Jesus, and it's awesome. But I mean, it with kindness and compassion wedded to that deeply, it's powerful. So anyway, sorry. Someone was going to say something over here. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, none of them. She was just pointing out how they got in this little huddle and they talked about it amongst themselves, and they decided, well, how can we frame this in a way that makes us look okay in the eyes of these people? And that wasn't helpful for the religious authorities. That's not what we want. That's not the kind of authority we're looking for from people in power. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Huh. Julius pointing out how he was really Socratic in the way he dealt with this. He asked questions to teach people. And that's an interesting point. Yeah, Socrates and Jesus had a lot of wisdom about how to deal with people. That's cool. Yeah, Jill? Yeah, that's good.
And he knew that, you know, the people would also, I mean, the people around them would know that answer. They said, well, if it's the same person, it came from God. You know, and they're just worried about their political standing, so they can't answer back what they know in their heart.
Yeah, she was pointing out how this is actually very similar to the Jewish practice of asking questions back and forth, kind of in a midrash type of dialogue, just responding back and forth in that kind of back and forth, almost playful manner. And also how Jesus really answered the question with this question later. They knew who he claimed to be, and his question actually answered that. And we're going to get into that too in a little bit. Was there one other person over here? Oh, yeah, Phil. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, he was pointing out how the authorities were so devoid of spirituality, and they were really more political, trying to be more concerned about the impact of what came out than what was really true. Yeah, that's good. Any other burning thoughts? Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, as you guys point out, one of the things that really stands out at the very beginning of this passage, these bad guys show up again. And we've seen them before in Mark's gospel. They're almost the people that you're supposed to hiss at when they show up on stage. Like, oh, those guys showed up again. Like, yeah, we don't like them. And we've seen them a couple times in chapter 2. They were actually judging Jesus in their hearts. And in other places, they've shown up and asked questions kind of to accuse Jesus. And now the opposition is really going to start building from this moment on, and it's going to climax in a couple chapters. But there, as I said before, there's also actually the main point of this passage really is about authority. Obviously, they're challenging authority. It's about who's in charge here, and I think the theme of it really is authorities with a small a versus capital A authority. Because we see these kind of bureaucrats come up and they want to challenge the real authority here. And so just on this topic of authority, there's a couple things that this passage is really saying about authority in this particular situation and in general too. That authority has to have some kind of source. It's got to come from somewhere or something. And usually that's outside of the person carrying it. And it also, there has to be a knowledge of it. You've got to know where it comes from, and you have to know that you have it at all. It has a lot to do with the identity of the person carrying that authority. And the question at stake really comes down to, who is in charge here? Who's in charge of the temple? And we see through this dialogue, it starts to be revealed who, at least who isn't in charge. In verse 28 here, we have these two questions that the authorities ask Jesus. They say, by what authority do you do these things? And they say, and who gave you this authority? And another way to put this might be, you just picture these kind of power-holding, bureaucratic, just more established people seeing this young kind of revolutionary in their eyes coming and showing up, and they come to him and they say, who do you think you are storming in here like this and disrupting things? And more importantly, they're asking, and who gave you permission, young man? And there's almost a patronizing quality to it. At the same time, there's also a subtle entrapment taking place, because they're hoping, as many people before, that he's going to reveal himself to be the kind of revolutionary that gets killed by the authorities when they have grounds to do it. So they're looking for grounds to get Jesus in a lot of trouble. And Jesus is just a little too wise to fall right in that tactic. Interestingly, Jesus chooses the timing for that to happen, but it's not yet. He has a lot more to say. And he makes a statement here in the form of this double-edged question. And I just want you to see the frame of this question. It's basically saying, I will question you, and you will answer me. In this statement here in verse 29, and in verse 30, this long question, he basically is making an indictment, and he's also giving an explanation. He's actually making a statement in the form of this question. He in verse 31, you see these guys, as some of you guys pointed out, they back up and they talk amongst themselves. Like, what do you think we should say? How can we phrase this just right? And then when they come out, they actually reveal, or in that even that conversation, we see an insight into what they're thinking. In verse 32, we see that they don't have a source of authority. What at the very basis motivates them is what? The fear of what the people think. They're basically confirming Jesus' subtle indictment that they don't really even have a source of authority backing them up as much as they present themselves that way. And this is in stark opposition to Jesus' clear heaven-based authority, as he gets to in this passage. Another thing that we see that they actually don't seem to have any knowledge either. They don't have that source of authority, and they at least say that they don't have any knowledge or discernment about what is going on. And if they do, it makes it even more clear they don't have authority, because they're cowards. They can't stand up for what they really think. If they deny the authenticity of John's baptism, they're afraid to say it. They're chickens. These guys are chickens. That's just another way to say it. And that's a really strong statement about who they are when they reveal themselves this way. They say in verse 33, they say, "We don't know. We have no discernment about that." And they should, because it's a really significant thing that's being challenged here. And I just wonder if Jesus was tempted to be sarcastic at that point. I wonder how many times Jesus held back thinking, I mean, because he was a pretty witty person. I just wonder, like, I wish we had the gospel with the sarcasm, like the fifth gospel with the sarcastic Jesus. It would be entertaining, but wouldn't be helpful in some ways. But I just wonder if he was tempted to, like, just say something, you know, to show what's going on. But he held back. And the second aspect of his question really revealed the statement, the answer that they were seeking for. Jesus' question in quote marks. He identified himself to be in solidarity with John the Baptist. He identified himself with the ministry of John the Baptist. This thing that within that, when Jesus came to his baptism, and I think Tim mentioned this in the call to worship, and we didn't collude on that. It's interesting how Tim brought this in, that it's clearly the Spirit's influence. But basically, in verse 10 of Mark chapter 1, when Jesus is going to be baptized by John, we see the heavens open. And who lives in heaven? God lives in heaven. We see the heavens open and God speak something that confirms who Jesus is. And we'll get to that shortly, but the answer is embedded in this after this indictment. And so really, Jesus is pointing back in a way to an initiation that took place that stamped and authenticated and affirmed his authority and his identity. He connects this discussion with baptism. And that leads us to this little bit of a detour that Lent is kind of imposing, and the passage is affirming about baptism in Lent. And I want to read something that describes Lent from one perspective. The key to understanding the meaning of Lent is simple: baptism. Preparation for baptism and the renewing of baptismal commitments lies at the heart of this season. Lent is radically baptismal. Now, in some ancient traditions, Lent's origins back in like the 3rd or 4th century came from a few different influences converging together, but it turned into this 40-day season of intense preparation, of thinking very hard, either because you're about to be initiated into the Christian faith with all of its powerful implications, or you're reflecting and remembering on the time when you were initiated into the Christian faith. So either way, it's a time of deep reflection, as we've all kind of seen as we've come on this journey the last couple weeks. There's a preparatory aspect and there is a remembering aspect for this Lenten baptismal season. And what we're really looking back on is how we came into our identity, how we were initiated into this thing called the way of Jesus. Now, all fraternal orders have some kind of initiation process. I have a couple friends that last year they graduated from med school. And this previous year, they've been in first year residency. And some of you guys are familiar with what that's like. Talk about an initiation. Talk about a baptism process. It's intense. 100-hour weeks, never sleeping, never knowing what's going to happen. And this is something that in the future that all doctors at least look back on and say, yeah, I remember that first year residency. Another profession that has something similar to this is architecture. We have a few architects in our community, and over the past couple years, there was one particular time where I had an interaction with a couple of them, and they were talking about this thing called studio. And some of you guys are familiar with with architecture and the training of it, there's this process called studio that they go through while they're taking classes. It's like 40 or 50 hours a week of preparation for a major project that basically tells you whether you can continue on in that process. It's quite an initiation of sorts, an intense time. And we all know the most obvious idea of initiation would be the fraternity process. The first week you're in college, if you're going to be in a fraternity, which I don't know if that's always a good thing, but you go through this process of initiation that's pretty crazy. Now, this isn't to say that Christianity is, or that baptism is a Christian version of hazing or anything, so I don't want to quite go that far. But you can see some strange connection looming back there, that there's something you go through that brings you into this process and that you look back on as a marker in your life. Now, baptism, it's really a time when your true self emerges. It's a time when there is a false self that is submerged and a new self emerges. And Brennan Manning calls this the... He's a Christian writer who's encouraged a lot of people I know. And he writes and calls this the imposter, the false self. And I want to read a little bit from another book quoting Brennan Manning. He says, "When I was 8, the imposter, or the false self, was born as a defense against the pain of life." Notice the key phrase, as a defense against the pain of life, as a way of saving himself. The imposter is our plan for salvation. So God must take it all away. This often happens at the start of our initiation journey. He thwarts our plan for salvation. He shatters the false self. You see that the imposter has to die so that the true self emerges. And we see this in the very imagery of baptism itself. But first, I want to point out something else interesting. Last week, Jesus made a pronouncement of judgment on the temple. He said, "This mountain will be cast into the sea, into the depths of the sea." And when you think about that for a minute, this submergence metaphor, and then bringing up baptism in the next passage when he's interacting with the authorities, is there any accident? I think there may be some connection there. It's quite fascinating to think this submerging, this drowning metaphor for the temple and what Jesus is instituting in his ministry. But this just brings us even closer to the symbolism of baptism. I think a lot of times, I had pretty much all my life thought of baptism as mostly kind of a washing. Like, and it definitely is an element of that. You go into this water, it's a cleansing, it's a washing, but it's much more than that. I want to read a little bit of a passage from this book that's a group of reflections on Lent called Bread and Wine, Readings for Lent and Easter. It's a really good thing to read if you guys can look at it during Lent. It's a great... thing to meditate on in the morning. It's like 3 pages each. But anyway, William Willimon, at the very beginning, he says this: "The chief biblical analogy for baptism is not the water that washes, but the flood that drowns. When Jesus was baptized, his baptism was not only the inauguration of his mission, but also a revelation of the shockingly unexpected nature of his mission. His baptism becomes a vignette of his own ministry. Why so shocking? On 2 occasions, Jesus uses baptism to refer to his own impending death. He asks his half-hearted disciples, 'Can you drink the cup that I must drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I must be baptized?'" That's Mark 10:38. "As he submits to John's bath of repentance, Jesus shows the radical way he will confront the sin that enslaves humanity. Jesus' baptism began in the Jordan and was completed on Golgotha." The washing of this prophetic baptism is not cheap. "You also must consider yourselves dead," Paul tells the Roman church in chapter 6. "In baptism, the old Adam is drowned." Later on, he goes on to describe just what it might be like to have seen these Jordan baptisms taking place. And he goes on to say, "On the bank of this dark river, as we are thrust backwards in time, onlookers might have remarked, 'They could kill somebody like that.' To which old John might say, 'Good, you're finally catching on.'" It's a little dark, isn't it? But this is Lent, so that's kind of the theme that's going on here. Lent is a time of pretty somber reflection, but it's something that's important to be reminded of, looking back on how we were initiated in the faith and what the symbolism of that is and what the implications are for us as people following the path of Christ. There's a symbolism of death and resurrection taking place. We go down and we come up. It's a powerful thing. If any of you guys have seen this show, I've been renting these DVDs of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I rented the first couple seasons. It's a show on cable. I think it's actually like been going for many years, but someone told me about it. And in one episode, the guy who's the hero of the show, he's definitely not a hero. The guy who's the main character in the show, it's the same person who produced Seinfeld. He's a Jewish guy, and there's someone in his family that is marrying a Christian, and so the Christian girl says, "You have to get baptized if we're going to get married." And he's like, "Okay." After a lot of soul searching, he says, "Okay, I guess I'll do this." And it just so happens that the main character of the show, Larry, is walking by this river, and he looks down and he sees this group of people. He sees some guy going under the water, and these people standing around and letting it happen. And he assumes what actually would be a pretty natural assumption: what, this guy's going backwards in the water, he's going to drown. And he runs down and says, "Stop! Somebody help that guy!" And totally interrupts the whole thing. and the guy ends up floating. One of the people ends up floating down the river, and it's just a huge ruckus, chaos. And this show is constantly got these kinds of awkward moments. And it's very awkward, obviously. They all just kind of stare at him like, "What's wrong with you?" And he just never gets it. Well, later on, they all get together at this house, and all of his Jewish friends say, "You know, you're such a hero. That was a great thing that you did, stopping Ben from doing this thing that he shouldn't have done, da-da-da-da-da." And he's like, "I wasn't trying to do anything." And it just was extremely awkward. But it just goes to show you a little bit deeper, just it's a graphic illustration of like what that is to see someone go under the water. It's a drowning metaphor. It's calculated to be that. This idea of associating with the death of Christ, this Paul calls this the fellowship of his suffering. And in Philippians chapter 3, verse 10, Paul describes it like this. He uses this language. He says, "I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so to attain to the resurrection from the dead." Now, Paul's accused of being kind of a dark thinker. He spends a lot of time talking about the death of Christ. And I think that's offensive to some people. Say, "Why is he always talking about the death thing?" But you have to think here. What comes after the death of Christ? What is the whole point of all creation? What is God doing? The resurrection. Death is a necessary precursor to the resurrection. Death is going to be conquered through this process that Jesus goes through. And we see this even in this passage, that the idea of this fellowship of the sufferings, what comes afterwards? When we look at Lent, it's a somber, reflective time. What is the point of it? We're looking towards Easter. We're spending this time doing somber reflection because we know that God is the one that vindicates his people, that all of our efforts to make ourselves saved and protected, they have to be shattered in order that God can do the real salvation, the real resurrection and restoration that Easter represents, that Easter is humanity coming into the fullness of all it was intended to be. So death is a necessary precursor to resurrection. That's why it's worthwhile reflecting on this somber season of Lent. Now, Paul uses this term fellowship. It also could be called participation, association, even identification could be associated with this idea here that I'm identifying with something outside of myself that I'm wanting to be a part of. I'm identifying with someone else and some other people. Now, this idea of baptism as identification, it has a couple of angles. There's an identification with something that takes place in baptism. There's also a reception of identity that we've kind of been touching on in this initiation idea. Now, the identifying with, Jesus identifies with all of humanity. He identifies with those to follow him at his baptism. Basically, the Messiah, Jesus, the Messiah is the king who represents his people. This is the longed-for person, and for him to truly represent and to truly lead his people to have authority, more than token authority, he must identify with them. He must go where he is leading them. He can't just sit up on his heavenly throne and say, "You guys need to go through a lot of trouble, and then maybe we'll resurrect you." No, he actually leads the way. And on the flip side of that, we also identify with Jesus when we follow his path, when we submit to baptism. We're identifying with Jesus, with the way of Christ and the way of God's vindication through what Christ did. And now there's also an identity reception. We receive our identity from God at that time. In the ancient church, in this there was a catechism process. It's actually still practiced in some Christian groups. And what you do is you're going through an intense time of instruction and reflection on what you're about to embark on in the Christian faith. Sometimes this could take several years. It's a very intense time of fasting and penitence and thinking. And it climaxes at Lent, right before the catechumen was baptized on Easter Day. Now, during this time, there's a naming ritual that takes place. Basically, you will take a great hero from the faith, from the past, that has virtues that you particularly identify with, and you'll say, I want that to be part of my identity. I want that to be my name. And you receive a Christian name, and this becomes a symbol of who you are in your true self. It might not even be a new identity. It might really be a restored identity. Or maybe even closer to the point, it might be an actual recognition of what was always true of you, but that was embedded and placed behind that false imposter self that has to be put to death. Now, for Jesus, it's definitely a recognition when he receives this identity. This is not a reception of a new identity. This is a recognition and an affirmation of what is really true and being unveiled to the people. In Mark 1, verse 11, when the heavens open, God says, this, you are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased. You are my son. Now, this is an echo of one of the earliest psalms, Psalm chapter 2, an enthronement psalm that describes the king and what God is promising to him and what he will be able to do with his inheritance. He says, you are my son. Now, in the Old Testament, the king is the son of God. That's who the king is. He is identified as the person who has even a filial relationship with God. God makes him his son. Now, also the son of God being the king, he is the true king. And what we know is true of the true king. This is the temple builder. The true king is the one who builds the temple, who restores the temple, the person who is in charge of all the affairs of the temple. This is the true king, Jesus. He has the authority. He is in charge of this temple building process that Jesus seems to be identifying with himself in these passages we're encountering here. So Jesus' identity, it reveals his authority that was revealed at his baptism, the true king, the son of God. Now, given that that is true and that's who he really is, I just wonder how might he have answered this question the Pharisees posed to him. Well, he might have alluded to 1 Chronicles 17, verse 11 and following, in his words, saying it, if this is how he would have said it. I am the descendant of David, whose kingdom God will establish. I will build a house for God, and he will establish my throne forever. God is my father, and I am his son. He will not take his loving kindness away from me as it was taken from my predecessors. My Father will establish me in his house, in his kingdom, forever. My throne will be established forever. That would have been a pretty intense answer in response to those authorities. He also might have alluded to Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and following. I am the one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. I will approach the Ancient of Days and be led into his presence. I am given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language will bow to me. My dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and my kingdom is one that will never be abolished. That might have quieted some people down. Actually, he saves that one for a couple chapters and pulls that one out when he's actually on trial, when he decides, okay, now's the time to really crank up the affairs of things here. But at this point, he finds it appropriate to use this subtle questioning form of response. He says, I will question you, and you will answer me. Now, what kind of people speak like this? Who speaks like this in the history of God's people? Does it have any echoes? Well, you guys are familiar with the story of Job. Now, Job is a person who undergoes tremendous suffering. God brings a storm into his life in a very literal way and disrupts his affairs and rearranges his life only to actually bring about much better things, even more blessings later. But in the process, Job is going through suffering and he maintains his integrity and his faithfulness to God, but not without kind of getting a little stroppy at some point. He gets a bit of an attitude, and his friends around him get an attitude too. And God comes along at the end, and we have this voice coming from the storm. I'm going to read from Job chapter 38, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. A couple chapters later, God reinforces this by saying again in chapter 40, verses 6 and 7, "Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me." Kind of interesting language. Sounds familiar. Do you guys ever feel hijacked by God? There's a metaphor that a lot of people use at Jacob's Well of being hijacked by God. I've had so many conversations with people that their life is going a certain direction, and God shows up and totally interferes with their plans and turns them in a totally different direction. This is totally my story and several other people that I, and probably a lot of us here. But sometimes God just brings a storm and reorients things in a way that we wouldn't have seen that actually ends up being far better and far more of a blessing to us and others than we had had on our own plans before. And sometimes at that point, you might find yourself playing the role of the authorities, the bureaucrats, saying, who's really in charge here? Am I in charge of my affairs? What right do you have to come in here and challenge the way I'm progressing with things? Sometimes God disrupts our sacred affairs, our sacred cows, and turns them around. And Jesus is just this kind of a provocateur, a storm bringer. You see, Jesus doesn't try to convince or plead with people. You see in the Gospels, how often does Jesus wring his hands and say, if you guys would just listen to me and believe me, please, I've got a great argument that'll talk you into seeing things my way. Jesus isn't an apologist. He's a provoker. He provokes responses from people. And that's exactly what happens in this situation. His actions provoke a major response. He brings a storm right into the center that all of these people thought was sacred and all the injustice that they had actually promoted in this seeming sacredness. And Jesus rearranges things. And so the question is, if that happens to us or to them, how do we respond? What is the best way to respond? What is wisdom that can give us a response? And I would suggest that we could do no better than to look at the responses of our ancient forebears in the faith and to look back at Job's response. At the very end of Job, his reply to God's challenges, he says, Job chapter 42, "Then Job replied to the Lord, 'I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you will answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I abase myself, and I repent in dust and ashes.'" Let's pray together for a few moments and reflect.